Back together again, you and I, on a Thursday, April 21st edition, 2022 of Connecticut Today. We welcomed UConn health epidemiologist Dr. David Banik back to the show for the very latest on COVID-19 and the debate over more boosters. Later on in the show, we also carried remarks from President Joe Biden. Earlier in the day, he updated the nation on more U.S. aid heading to Ukraine's military in its ongoing battle against Russian forces. And we continue here on a Thursday edition of Connecticut Today, right here, WICC 600 AM, 107.3 FM, and online at WICC600.com. Back to open phones momentarily. First, though, we're happy to welcome back Dr. David Banik. He's an associate professor of medicine at the UConn School of Medicine, also the hospital epidemiologist at UConn Health John Dempsey Hospital. And we've been chatting with experts, including Dr. Banik, throughout the pandemic here with Omicron and now BA2 and the original virus and all of that. Dr. Banik, Paul here again. How are you, sir? Great to have you back. How you been?
I'm doing well, thanks. Thanks for having me on again.
Well, it's great to have you back here. Well, let's talk about the boosters, Dr. Banik, and also, I guess, we have this variant now of a variant, correct? This is the BA2 variant now that you folks in the medical community are focusing on. Talk a little about that, and is it behaving the way you thought or not?
Sure. So, I think what we're referring to is the BA2. It's actually a subvariant of the Omicron variant. So you may recall over the past couple of years, we've had different variants. We had the Alpha variant and Beta, Delta, and now we've most recently have had the Omicron variant. And this variant is a little unique in that it has several changes to it, which seem to make it more transmissible, easier to spread from person to person. And the BA2 subvariant, which is the predominant subvariant now here in Connecticut and throughout the U.S., is a particular form of the Omicron variant that seems to be highly contagious, and that's really what we're seeing spread throughout the community.
How does this compare, Dr. Banik, with the variants and subvariants that you mentioned with previous viruses? Is this playing out kind of the way that you folks envisioned, or are there any little twists and turns here that may be surprising you?
So, I think what we're seeing with these coronavirus variants in some way would be anticipated. You know, we know these types of viruses can change and mutate and lead to new variants. So that's something that was sort of known. But I think, to the extent that this would happen and the way that these variants would spread, this is something that we're learning as we move through the pandemic. Certainly this pandemic is nothing like we've seen in the past. Our ability also to understand virus changes in real time by detecting new variants is also a very new technology. Fortunately, we do have the tools to be able to do surveillance and identify new subvariants and changes. That's really important, something that we're going to have to keep an eye on in the months and likely years ahead.
We are talking once again about COVID-19, all the variants and subvariants, with Dr. David Banik. We welcome him back. He's an associate professor of medicine at UConn Med School, a hospital epidemiologist at UConn Health John Dempsey Hospital. Dr. Hangout, we'll be right back with you. We'll get into the boosters, how those are faring, and more about the latest concerning COVID-19. First, traffic and weather together right here on WICC. And we continue here on a Thursday. It's Connecticut Today. Paul Pacelli here. Thanks for hanging out with us. Back to open phones momentarily. The guest, as we continue with Dr. David Banik, an associate professor of medicine at the UConn School of Medicine and the hospital epidemiologist at UConn Health John Dempsey Hospital, as we talk continuing about what is going on with COVID-19. Doctor, let's get to the vaccinations and the boosters now. Recently, a second booster was okayed for those of us 50 and over. I got mine a few days ago, so I'm all up to date. But as we're looking now, doctor, at the second booster, back to the first, back to the two inoculations if you have the Pfizer, how has this whole thing played out with the inoculations, and now we're in booster number two? Again, I'll ask kind of what you folks expected, some twists and turns. What are you seeing as far as the data is concerned?
Sure. So I think, you know, in some ways with these COVID vaccines, you know, we're building off of some existing understanding of vaccines, but also learning a little bit more as the pandemics progress. So, you know, we know that vaccines provide very robust immunity that became clear with the initial vaccines. But as we expected and we've seen with other vaccines, as time passes, that immunity, or at least the antibody component of the immunity, does wane over time. And that's something that you know, we've seen in prior vaccinations. And that component of the immune response, the antibody response, is part of what protects against infection. So, you know, we're seeing antibody titers wane, which is what's brought up the role of the boosters. You know, we saw the initial boosters do provide a bump in those antibodies and a higher level of protection against infection, including severe infection. And over time, as we expected, particularly in older individuals, that antibody continues to wane, which is why the second boosters have now become part of the way that we can protect ourselves against against COVID. So, you know, again, building on some existing understanding of vaccines, but also, you know, learning how to adapt it to this novel virus and the changes that we're seeing.
Is it the novel nature of the COVID virus, Dr. Banik, and all the subvariants that are making these shots necessary relatively close together? You know, oftentimes I read or people ask, well, why are we needing all of these shots in a relatively short amount of time? Whereas, you know, somebody says, geez, I got a shot as a kid for something. I got one booster when I was like 18 or 20, and I haven't had it since. Explain the difference here. Why is that?
So, you know, I think part of that relates to coronaviruses in general. So, you know, we all get exposed to coronaviruses, like seasonal coronaviruses, throughout our lives and other respiratory viruses. The issue with COVID-19 is that it was a very novel coronavirus, so no one had been previously exposed to it. There was no pre-existing immunity. The other challenge with these coronaviruses is that the immunity to them can become transient, and that's both from infection but also from vaccination, and that's what we're seeing. So we're seeing that the antibody levels and the protection after an infection or vaccination against coronaviruses seems to wane a little bit more than we see with other types of viruses. So, you know, you may recall, you know, measles viruses, mumps viruses, vaccines that are part of the standard childhood immunization schedule. And the protection for those types of viruses is very, very long, you know, many years, decades. But for coronaviruses, less so, just by nature of the way the viruses attack our body, replicate, and you know, just the way that our immune system responds in general. So not too surprising, knowing what we know about coronaviruses, but remember, this is the first time we've ever had a vaccine against a coronavirus that's been administered. So, you know, still learning as we move forward.
So is that why, Doctor, people constantly are asking, and it may not bear out here, what about a natural immunity? When is that going to kick in? Is that ever possible? Is that some of the thinking here, is that we've just not been exposed to this thing long enough?
Well, I think that is true. You know, we're learning about the immune response both to natural infection as well as to vaccine induced immunity. So we're learning about the immunity, the durability of that immunity. It does seem like there is some protection that's conferred. You know, probably a very high level of protection in the months, you know, the initial months after getting a vaccine or an infection, but that does wane over time. And we're seeing that in individuals who are developing infection, either after having a prior infection or after having been vaccinated. So, you know, it is something that we're learning more and more about. You know, certainly our understanding of the immune response to coronaviruses over the last couple of decades has exploded. You know, this is something that we did know a little bit about in the scientific community, but, you know, certainly now we know exponentially more about how the immune system responds to these viruses. And we'll continue to learn more, and hopefully that'll lead to a better understanding of how to protect ourselves with vaccinations.
Regarding this availability of now an approved second dose of a booster, so up to four shots now, the two original if you're on Pfizer, and a second booster shot, what would you say to someone, Doctor, who says, hey, I feel good, maybe I've had COVID once, I had the two shots, I've gotten the first booster, but I'm not really sold on the second one? What would your opinion be on that?
Well, I think, you know, when it comes to the second booster, you know, I think what we know is that there is additional antibody response to a second booster, and that likely confers additional protection. You know, I think the individuals who would benefit most would be older individuals. Yeah, I think it's currently available to individuals 50 and older, but the older that you get, the waning of antibody tends to occur quicker. So I think those older individuals, you know, 65 and older, would benefit most. And then those individuals who have medical comorbidities or medical conditions that make them at higher risk for developing severe COVID. You know, those are really the two groups that I think benefit most from the second booster. You know, as I mentioned, it is authorized and available to individuals who are 50 and older.
And finally, doctor, look into your crystal ball a little bit, if you can here. The notion that, you know, this may become an annual shot that we would be offered, you know, along with the flu shot and some other stuff, pneumonia. What are your thoughts on that?
So, you know, I think, you know, what this is going to look like in the future, you know, I don't think anyone can make any clear-cut predictions. You know, we've learned anything from the last couple of years is that we can sort of expect that unexpected things will happen. We've seen that with new variants that have been that have changed in ways that we hadn't expected. But, you know, I think in terms of the vaccinations, so, you know, I think there's good anticipation that COVID-19 will be with us for, you know, at least the months and years in the near future. And, you know, how we're going to protect ourselves is going to depend on a few factors. It's going to depend on how durable these vaccines and the boosters are in terms of their protection. We'll also need to be looking at any changes in variants that might arise, and would need special attention with regard to potentially new vaccines that might be adapted to them. And then, you know, lastly, this will all depend on what we see with the virus circulation. So, you know, if we see virus circulating in any sort of pattern, you know, that would provide guidance as far as when to time future vaccinations. So, you know, a lot of questions at play, certainly a lot that we'll learn in the next few months that will help provide an understanding as to what the role might be of future vaccines.
Dr. David Banik, Associate Professor of Medicine, UConn Med School, and the Hospital Epidemiologist at UConn Health John Dempsey Hospital. Dr. Banik, good to chat with you. Thank you so much. We appreciate it, and hopefully we can talk down the line. Thanks.
All right. Thanks so much for having me.
Today, I'm announcing another $800 million to further augment Ukraine's ability to fight in the east, in the Donbas region. This package includes heavy artillery weapons, dozens of howitzers, and 144,000 rounds of ammunition to go with those howitzers. It also includes more tactical drones. In the past 2 months, we've moved weapons and equipment to Ukraine at record speed. We've sent thousands of anti-armor and anti-missile helicopters, drones, grenade launchers, machine guns, rifles, radar systems. More than 50 million rounds of ammunition had already been sent. The United States alone has provided 10 anti-armor systems for every one Russian tank that's in Ukraine, a 10-to-1 ratio. We're sharing and will continue to share significant timely intelligence with Ukraine to help defend them against Russian aggression. And on top of this, these direct contributions from the United States, we're facilitating, we're the outfit facilitating the significant flow of weapons and systems to Ukraine from other allies and partners around the world, like the S-300 long-range anti-aircraft systems that Slovakia recently transferred to Ukraine. We are getting them in there. We won't always be able to advertise everything we that our partners are doing to support Ukraine and fight for freedom, but to modernize Teddy Roosevelt's famous advice, sometimes we will speak softly and carry a large javelin, because we're sending a lot of those in as well. You know, but we're not sitting on the funding that Congress has provided for Ukraine. We're sending it directly to the front lines of freedom, to the fearless and skilled Ukrainian fighters who are standing in the breach. You got to admit, you must be amazed at the courage of this country, the resolve that they're showing, not just their military, but the average citizen, men and women, young men, young women as well. It's, you know, the sustained and coordinated support of the international community, led and facilitated by the United States, is a significant reason why Ukraine is able to stop Russia from taking over their country thus far. Every American taxpayer, every member of our armed forces can be proud of the fact that our country's generosity and the skill and service of our military helped arm and repel Russia's aggression in Ukraine, to beat back Putin's savagery that tried to seize Ukraine's capital and wipe out Ukraine's government. The Battle of Kyiv was a historic victory for the Ukrainians. It was a victory for freedom, won by the Ukrainian people with unprecedented assistance by the United States and our allies and our partners. Now we have to accelerate that assistance package to help prepare Ukraine for Russia's offensive that's going to be more limited in terms of geography, but not in terms of brutality. Combined with our recent drawdowns, it will ensure a steady flow of weapons and equipment into Ukraine over the next few weeks. However, with this latest disbursement, I've almost exhausted the drawdown authority I have that Congress authorized for Ukraine in a bipartisan spending bill last month. In order to sustain Ukraine for the duration of this fight, next week I'm going to have to be sending to Congress a supplemental budget request to keep weapons and ammunition flowing without interruption to the brave Ukrainian fighters and continue to deliver economic assistance to the Ukrainian people. My expectation is Congress would move and act quickly. And I want to thank the Congress, Democrats and Republicans, for their support for the people of Ukraine. Our unity at home, our unity with our allies and partners, and our unity with the Ukrainian people is sending an unmistakable message to Putin. He will never succeed in dominating and occupying all of Ukraine. He will not, that will not happen. In addition to bolstering Ukraine's resistance on the battlefield, we're also demonstrating our support for the people of Ukraine. Today, the United States is announcing that we intend to provide an additional $500 million in direct economic assistance to the Ukrainian government. This brings our total economic support for Ukraine to $1 billion in the past 2 months. This is money the government can help use to stabilize their economy, to support communities that have been devastated by the Russian onslaught, and pay the brave workers that continue to provide essential services to the people of Ukraine. You know, these past weeks have seen a terrible human cost of Putin's ambition for conquest and control. Approximately two-thirds of all Ukrainian children have been displaced from their home. More than 5 million Ukrainians have fled their country. It's an absolute outrage. The idea this is happening, approaching the second quarter of the 21st century, is just, Last month, when I was in Europe, I announced that the United States would welcome 100,000 Ukrainians so that we share in the responsibility of supporting Ukrainians fleeing Putin's war machine. We've already welcomed tens of thousands of Ukrainians to the United States, and today I'm announcing a program, Unite for Ukraine, a new program to enable Ukrainians seeking refuge to come directly from Europe to the United States. This new humanitarian parole program will complement the existing legal pathways available to Ukrainians, including immigrant visas and refugee processing. It will provide an expedient channel for secure legal migration from Europe to the United States for Ukrainians who have a U.S. sponsor, such as a family or an NGO. This program will be fast, it will be streamlined, and will ensure the United States honors its commitment to go to the people of Ukraine and need not go through our southern border. We're also continuing to ratchet up the pressure on Putin and further isolate Russia on the world stage. Yesterday, the Treasury Department rolled out additional measures to crack down on the entities and individuals attempting to evade our unprecedented sanctions, not just ours, but throughout the West. Today, I'm announcing that the United States will ban Russian-affiliated ships from our ports as they did in Europe. That means no ship, that sails under the Russian flag or that is owned or operated by a Russian interest will be allowed to dock in a United States port or access our shores. None. This is yet another critical step we're taking in concert with our partners in the European Union, the United Kingdom, Canada, and further to deny Russia the benefits of international economic system that they so enjoyed in the past. We don't know how long this war will last, but as we approach the two-month mark, here's what we do know. Putin has failed to achieve his grand ambitions on the battlefield. After weeks of shelling Kyiv still stands. President Zelensky and his democratically elected government still remain in power. and the Ukrainian armed forces, joined by many brave Ukrainian civilians, have thwarted Russia's conquest of their country. They've been bolstered from day one by an unstinting supply of weapons, ammunition, armor, intelligence from the nations of the free world, led by us, the United States. As Russia continues to grind out the military advances and their military advances and the brutalities against Ukraine, Putin is banking on us losing interest. That's been my view. You heard me say this from the beginning. He was counting on NATO, European Union, our allies in Asia, cracking, moving away. He's betting on Western unity will crack. He's still betting on that. And once again, we're going to prove him wrong. We will not lessen our resolve. We're going to continue to stand with the brave and proud people of Ukraine. We will never fail in our determination to defend freedom and oppose tyranny. It's as simple as that. So again, I want to thank the American people. Thank the American people for their support of the Ukrainian people. This is our responsibility, it seems to me, and we've been able to hold the whole world together in this effort. So thank you very much. Thank you.